I'm Jeff Fisher, and I'm here to talk about practical politics. So if that's not what you want to hear about, you're in the wrong room. And now is your chance to leave. And this is going to be a real worldview. I mean, it's going to be very quick. I don't have a lot of time to go over in detail, but I'm going to basically try to go over a few things. I want to lay out to you what our government looks like. We're going to talk about how we make decisions in Texas, elections and conventions, and we're going to talk about the structure and then how best to be involved. Tell you what, before we get started, let me start with a prayer. Father, we just thank you for this day. We thank you for the opportunity to be in a land that we can be involved in our government. And Father, we just praise you for this system that you showed our founding fathers, and that they developed, Father. And God, I just ask now that you anoint our time, and that, Father, that this will be a good time for everyone involved. And God, we just praise you, we just thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, first of all, when we're talking about civil government, who can tell me what are the different levels of civil government that we have out there? Okay, we have federal, correct, which is the national government, the state government. And then up under that, you're talking about county government, city or local government, and then school districts or whatever, and then some even have some smaller entities. But that's basically what you're going to see in most areas. Now, when you're talking about the federal government, we have a system that's broken up into three sections: judiciary, legislative, and executive. And I'm not going to go into great detail about any of these, other than to say that judiciary is obviously the court system, the highest court being the Supreme Court. It has district courts up under it, and that's basically the structure of the judiciary. The executive is made up basically of the president and his appointed cabinet members. It's obviously much larger than it was 200 years ago when this was laid out, but the executive is very, very large now. In fact, the president makes about 6,500 appointments within the first few weeks of being in office. So it has moved from a very small part of government to one that is very, very large and out of control. Regardless of who's in the White House, it is entirely large. The legislative branch at the federal level is made up of two parts: the United States Senate, which is we get two senators from each state, each of the 50. 2 times 50 is 100, so we get 100 members of the Senate. Plus, the Vice President of the United States is the President of the Senate, and he sets over the Senate, and the only time he votes is in the case of a tie. And Vice President Dole has had to do that twice since being there. Gore. Vice President Gore has voted twice to break ties, and it's really the only time I can remember in recent history that it's happened. He did it once to break the tie on the budget, the first budget that President Clinton brought forward, and he did it the second time on a jobs, what do you call it, economic, can't remember the word for it, but it was, anyway, it's a nonsense thing. So anyway, that's the only time he's going to vote. Now, the U.S. House has made up of 435 members, and it is those members, that number never changes, but the number of each state changes based on population. So, like, Texas had, before the 1990 census, Texas had 27 congressmen. Today they have 30. Well, we picked up three new ones. Pennsylvania lost one or two, and New York lost one or two. And so we picked up, and there were some others, but I'm just saying that some states lose, some states gain. The overall number of those states is the same. So it's always 435. And then there's a Speaker of the House, which is elected by the majority of the U.S. House of Representatives. So the Speaker will always reflect the party affiliation of the majority. So now we have a Republican majority in the U.S. House, so there's a Republican Speaker, which is the first time in 40-some years. At the state level, in Texas, it's basically the same, except in the courts, we have, in the judiciary branch, in the courts, we have two two paths. We have the Texas Supreme Court. Can anyone tell me what the Texas Supreme Court does? Okay, it deals with civil case. Texas Supreme Court is not a criminal court. It does not deal with the U.S. Supreme Court would deal with any case. But in Texas, we have two basically Supreme Courts. One of them is Texas Supreme Court, which deals with civil, and then the Court of Criminal Appeals, which deals with criminal cases. And we are the only state in Texas to still have a Court of Criminal Appeals as a separate court system. I mean, only state in the union. And that will probably. They may have. I was under the impression that they had all been now disbanded. Except this one. I know Louisiana had one, but okay. And so, Court of Criminal Appeals deals with criminal cases. The Texas Supreme Court deals with civil cases. We have an executive branch. Who is the executive branch in Texas? The governor, Governor Bush. And he is allowed to make appointments just like President Clinton does at the federal level. Although not quite as large, it has become a very large part of the Texas government. And in reality, it's actually the most power the governor of Texas has, is the appointment of the heads of the different agencies and the appointments of lots of different things that come up. He really has no power within the process of legislation in Texas, other than to politically play hardball by holding appointments hostage or things like that. Legislatively, it looks just like the federal. We have a Senate made up of 31 members. Bob Dole, who is the lieutenant governor, is the president of the Senate.
Bullock.
Gosh, I can't get him off his name. Bob Bullock, who is the lieutenant governor, and that is an elected statewide position. And it is not like the federal in the sense that the President Clinton ran with Vice President Gore, and the vice president automatically became the president of the U.S. Senate. In Texas, they were in separate. In Texas, there's never been two Republicans, both governor and lieutenant governor, and so it makes for an interesting arrangement. U.S. House in Texas, the Texas House is 150 members, and again, it's just like the federal level. It always stays 150. Counties may pick up additional seats, like Tarrant County is a growing county. The next census, I think there's nine, I believe it's right, so, no, I don't remember, 7, 8, 9, over here in Tarrant now. When the next census comes up, there's not any doubt that there will be more than that over here because of the population and so on. Now, as far as how we make decisions and I'm not going to go into trying to break down county, city, and school governments because they are so different going from one city to another. County governments are pretty much always the same. It's normally a county commissioner court with a county judge sitting on top of it. And in most cases, it's going to be five members, four county commissioners, and then one county judge that sits on top of that. And in city government, there's just a lot of different ways it looks. And the same with school districts, although they will always have a school board, and a city will always have a city council. But then up under that, there's a lot of different things that can be done. As far as how we make decisions in Texas, there's two ways. You can do it by convention. You can do it by election. Now, when you have election, that's just what it sounds like. You go to the polls, you cast a vote, somebody wins. And the way we put people on the ballot in Texas is through a primary. Now, a primary is really not an election as far as you're not electing them to office. What you're doing in a primary is you're making a decision as a party, either a Democrat or a Republican Party, of who you want to be your nominee. So who is going to represent you as the Republican Party on the County Commissioner's Court in November against whomever the Democrats nominate through their primary in November. So the primary is nothing but a nominations process. It's just how we get there. Some states don't have primaries. Some states have caucuses. And I suspect that in the near future, you're going to see Texas try to move toward that, where the statewide office holders, it just depends on state, down to a certain level, are nominated through their convention. Like, if for those of you that have been involved in the state convention, we nominate at the state convention a state party chairman, a state party vice chairman, and a number of other officials. In states that have caucuses, and that's the way that they do their nominations, they will also nominate the governor, they will nominate the lieutenant governor, they will nominate the U.S. senator, they will nominate their congressman, and so on. And there's certainly pros and cons to that, the biggest pro being that it puts the nominations in the hands of the grassroots. The biggest downside to an open primary is, this last one is a great example of what happens. If you get a Kay Granger in a race for a Republican nomination, who's her base? It was certainly the liberal wing of the Republican Party, but also the Democrat Party. That's where she came out of. Then what you see happen is a lot of Democrats come into the Republican primary to vote for Kay Granger. Well, that's certainly one thing, but then what do they do after they vote for Granger? Who knows? But they cause havoc because they do not. So in other words, you end up with a situation where you have one party coming into another party and helping make decisions for the other party, which is not a good process. It didn't have that big an effect up here, but in a race down in south of here, the Greg Laughlin race, who was a Democrat that changed parties, we lost some races up under that one because of the fact that there were 17,000 Democrats who for the first time came in and voted in the Republican primary. Now, some of those obviously are coming in because they had a change of heart. They saw what's going on, and they made a move. But many of those were just coming in to vote for Greg Laughlin. And then, like I said, once they come in, then there's no telling what they do up under. So that's kind of the negative of that. You know, the positive is that it's certainly open, and everyone who wants to participate can. Not that the convention is not open, but it does take a little more effort to be involved in the convention process. So you probably, in fact, for those of you that are going to be at the state convention this time, this probably will be an item of discussion. I think you're going to see some type of a rule change to try to move Texas toward a caucus. Conventions start in fact, I think I'll come back to that later. Okay, let's talk about political groups. The political process in Texas is a great process. And it's one that is so easy to be involved in, but you must understand how it works. Now, at the bottom of the totem pole, you have what we call a precinct. Now, a precinct is nothing but it's a political boundary. It's just like a county is a county boundary. A precinct is just a political boundary. Texas is divided up into 8,100 precincts, and each of these 8,100 precincts combined make up the political structure of Texas politics. Precincts typically are going to run between 1,000 and 2,000 registered voters, and some of them may have any more than 10, and I've seen a couple that have 6,000, 7,000. But typically, they're going to run between 1,000 and 2,000 voters. And this is the backbone of the entire political structure. This is where, even though most people don't want to hear this is where you make the biggest difference, is in your local precinct. And your local precinct, just think of it as your neighborhood. If you want to see Bill Clinton as president or Bob Dole as president, the biggest impact you can have is in your precinct. It's not trying to leave this room and figure out, now how do I go help the people in Dallas elect Bob Dole? You know, you take care of your own backyard first. It's like when Nehemiah and they rebuilt the walls, he had each of the families basically build the wall around their house for a number of reasons, one of which they're probably going to be a lot more concerned about what's happening in their backyard than they are on the other side of town. And the same philosophy holds true. This is the bottom of the whole process. All right, I'm going to skip over some of it, but And then above that, we have 150 House districts, which are made up of about 95,000 voters in Texas, not necessarily registered, but potential. And then above that, we have 31 state Senate districts. They're gonna run about 500,000. And then really, as far as size goes, but we have 30 congressional districts. They run about 544,000. And then, of course, we have the statewide. Statewide, there's about 18 million in Texas. And of that 18 million, there's a little less than 10 million registered. And of the 18 million, there's about 13.8 eligible. So there's 13.8 million people in Texas that are of voting age. About 9.6 million of those are registered. And of the 9.6, only about 5 million will vote in a big election, like the governor or the president. So you've got 5 million people on a good election making decisions for 18. And when you start talking about, if you were to calculate the numbers like for House districts, across the state, this number is going to drop down to about 2. So that's the reason we have a problem. While term limits is certainly a fast fix to some degree, term limits won't take care of the problem, because the problem is we got voter apathy out there. And as long as this is the case, you may change the names, but you're still going to have the same problem. I mean, whether you put Ted Kennedy in the U.S. Senate or you put Patrick Kennedy in the U.S. Senate, makes very little difference. And that won't change until we see more involvement. Now, the precinct is the building block. What's happening, though, is that the mood in America is, let's look at what's happening at the top of the ticket, and let's focus on that. How many of you were involved in presidential politics in the primary? 5, 6. How many of you were involved in county commissioner race? How many of you worked in a presidential or did something for the presidential candidate? And then how many of you did something for a county commissioner? So we got 1 and 4 or 5. Typically, that's what we're seeing out there, is that the excitement is Pat Buchanan, or the excitement is Bob Dole, or the excitement in a gubernatorial year is George Bush. And the excitement, and that's, don't get me wrong, I hope those guys win. But what I am more concerned about is what we're doing down here. Because this is where we're going to build the foundation. If you cannot build a house from the top down, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We could put the Apostle Paul up here, guys, and we'd still have a mess, because there's nothing under it. And you've got to build the house first. There's 8,100 precincts. If you had 8,100 Christian activists with solid worldviews that were precinct chairmen over these 8,100 precincts, we'd have a foundation. And cooperatively, then you're talking about starting to have something in place that you can elect a county commissioner, or you can elect a state rep, or you can elect a state senator. But as long as we're not ready to come down here and organize our precincts, and by organizing I mean doing walks in your precincts to try to learn more about the people, to get those people who represent your worldview out to vote in elections. That's the real political game. That's where it's really won. And there's really two ways that you run a campaign. You can do what we call grassroots, which is organizing precincts, and identifying your vote and getting them out. Or you can do a mass media campaign. Of course, mass media is what we're seeing now, especially at the top of the ticket. And normally, mass media is most of the time is going to be anything from a state senate up. A state senate campaign in Texas, if it's contested, will run normally around $1 million. Congressional races will run about the same. In a statewide race, like a gubernatorial race, you're looking between $20 and $30 million. Most of that will be on media buys. So they're just the concept is we're just going to saturate the airways out there, and then as you know, you get tired of watching them. But that's the mentality. And if you don't have a political structure out there, that's the only thing you can do. So you either have to spend your energy and your time organizing precincts, and then on up from there, or you have to spend your energy and time just mass media throwing a message out there and hoping that it sells. Now, from the ideal world says, you know, we're going to organize precincts, and then from the precinct level, the next thing we want to see is conservative Christian people run for local school board and local city council. And what we're going to do is we're going to start building a farm team. There's not a major league team out there today that has a successful major league program that does not have a great farm team. And the political system is no different. The most important elections that will happen in 1996 will not be the President of the United States. It will be what we do at the local level. Will we elect local school board members? Will we elect local city council members? Will we elect county commissioners? In 1978, in Travis County, there was a young lady that ran for county commissioner. She was previously a precinct chairman in Austin. She won that election. And 12 years later, Ann Richards was governor of Texas. In 1966, there was a man in Harris County that ran for Republican Party chairman. And 14 years later, George Bush was vice president of the United States. And that's where we are today. And the exciting thing is, around the state, there is a lot of bottom activity. We are winning a lot of races. In the past primary, on the Republican side of the ticket, there was about 20 conservative Christians with solid worldviews that ran for the State House of Representatives in the primary. We got 17 of those out of the primary. 1992, many of us were working on the state school board. And we saw that there was a serious problem in what was being done down there and the type of textbooks that were coming out of there and just the entire philosophy of what was happening. So we thought it might be a neat idea to start putting some conservative Christians on the state school board. Well, in 1992, we had one. On March the 8th, with the election of Richard Neal here, we just put the sixth one on there. We have two for the fall. If we win those two, for the first time in the history of Texas, we'll have a conservative Christian majority on state school board. Now, that's a bottom-up approach. But it's not something that happens tomorrow morning. It's something that you've got to say, this is where I am today. Now, what do I need to do to move in that direction? Well, I got news for you guys. I can't elect Bob Dole. And some days I don't know if I want to elect Bob Dole. But what I can do is I promise you I can recruit precinct chairmen, and I can teach them how to work their precinct, and I can help elect local school in my area. I can help elect a school board member, and I can do those things. And if we'll go back to doing that, then we're going to see a change in this whole structure. I was a chief of staff for a congressman for about a year. And one of the most frustrating things is once you get here is all these guys are throwing bombs at you because we're not this. Yes, there's a Republican majority in Congress, and there's a great group of freshmen up there that are gung-ho and ready to do things, but they ain't got any support under here. And so back home, they're just getting killed because the county commissioner courts are throwing bombs at them, or the JPs are throwing bombs at them, or whatever. So it is so important that we go back to the bottom and build this house. And when we do that, again, you're going to see some real positive results. And the areas that it's happening now, we are successful, and we are seeing things happen for the good. there's a lot of on the decision front, when you start talking about local entities like school boards, city councils, county commissioners, they make a lot of decisions that affect you. I mean, school board affects, to some degree, they affect textbook selection. To some degree, they affect just the general tone of the class, of what's going to be allowed in there. Certainly, when you start talking about the wild sex education stuff, and any of that is always going to be in control of the local board. They will control your pocketbook. Who brings school bond elections to you? School board. Same with city council. City council, now the way things are beginning to shape out, city councils are even having an impact on schools. You're seeing more and more partnerships between cities and local districts trying to do things. Like in Austin, where I lived for a number of years, we had a city council that was somewhat out of control, and they passed a domestic partner policy to give homosexual and unmarried couples the same benefits as married. Of course, we ended up having to go to the ballot down there, and we beat them. But the key is that we had a city council who was certainly did not hold a Christian worldview. And you can talk and you can educate and you can do everything you want to do. But if they do not hold to a Christian worldview, they ain't gonna see it. And other than the fact that occasionally you can put enough political pressure on some of them to get them to vote right, you got a high maintenance group of people that you're gonna have to do something with. County commissioners, when you talk about the abortion issue, they regulate the county hospitals. The county commissioner is the ones that makes the decision of whether or not a county hospital performs abortions. So not only is it the farm team and how you build a political process, there's an incredible amount of decisions being made in this lower group that affect all of us. I don't think we have to go over what the state house and all those guys do, but it's a bottom-up approach, and that's the way we've got to look at it. Before I go any further, let me entertain questions on what we've gone over up to now, or y'all may know everything. Yes.
I come back to that. We were talking a little bit about the education, the school boards, the city council, the media. Because I've been kind of working with people for several years in this area, and it's very difficult to get the word out. It seems like people are too married to their jobs, mm-hmm. working to pay attention, and they think that the schools are in good hands. After all, mm-hmm. their neighbor is on the board.
Right.
And there's also this kind of marriage in this community between the city council, which you're talking about, because you see there's a great deal of money involved with developing this area.
Right.
And many call themselves Christian. They are Christian. They attend church. Mm-hmm. They're deacons.
Mm-hmm.
But yet in all, they are tied to the economy, and they want the schools sitting here. They want no conflict. And then the unions are so powerful. The school board, several of the members, their wives are teachers, are in administration. Pastors' wives,
mm-hmm.
are teaching in administration, these mm-hmm. kinds of things. And there's just so much deception. It's, how do you even? I just get so frustrated. I can't even.
Yeah. Well, you know, she brings up a good point. She's talking about the fact that it's the what's in front of us is pretty overwhelming. I mean, you have a lot of enemies, if you will. You know,
whenever you can't even get the support, like you said, local, the church,
mm-hmm.
the pastors, there is no support. They want no divisiveness.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to hear about it. They don't think that there's a problem.
Right.
You're the problem.
Oh, I agree. Well, it's, you know, I'll give you a good example. The State Board of Education in 1993 adopted some health textbooks that set off quite a firestorm, and it was because of the content. When you start talking about kids debating on whether or not they should be allowed to divorce their parents, the legalization of drugs, and a number of other things, it ticks off parents, and they went nuts. Well, now the board had a couple of options here. Now we can either pull in the publishers, because this isn't the first time. I mean, we got history books that are full of errors. We got math books that don't teach math. You know, we got readers that are full of New Age. You know, we got environmental science books that we just adopted that say that the free market enterprise system is what's wrong with America. and so on. Well, now you can either pull in the publishers and you can say, you know, we're paying, you know, $100 million a year for books, and we expect good books. In fact, Alabama typically adopts what Texas adopts, but in 1992, Alabama refused to adopt the history books that was adopted here. They called them toxic textbooks because of the errors, but they're in our classrooms. Well, so you can either do that. You can either pull the publishers in. You can say, okay, guys, them days are over. From now on, we want top-rate textbooks. We believe our kids deserve the best they can be put in the classroom. Or you can go in and fix the process so that the public's not in the input anymore, which is what they're trying to do now. So they pull the content requirements out, which is what exactly they're trying to do right now, is remove content requirements for textbooks. Well, that fixes the problem because there's no longer any input. So there is no firestorm because the board has no authority to reject books based on content. They will only have authority to reject books based on whether or not the color of the cover is right or not, but not on the content of the book. And that's what's happening at the local level too. It's the same type of thing.
If you're a parent, you want to go and look at a book, you're getting emails about the only one on.
Right. So, but in order to get back and do anything about it, we're going to have to go back again. We're going to have to go back to the bottom. We're going to have to go to our neighborhood, our neighbors, and we're going to have to make them. We're going to have to build an army, if you will, from the bottom. And I'll just tell you, I don't believe that we'll ever see a huge majority that will stand up. Now, I think done correctly, I think you can get a majority to vote with you. But don't ever expect to see your entire church stand up with you when you start talking about a controversial issue, whether you're talking about the abortion issue, you're talking about schools or whatever. The schools is very delicate. I watch polls all the time on it. And basically the polls all say the same thing. Parents think their local schools are doing a pretty good job. Well, but why wouldn't they? They have to. If they don't, they're admitting that they're bad parents. If you say that school's no good, but my kid's in it, that doesn't say a lot for. So, but then when you ask them the question, well, what do you think about the direction education is going as a whole? They will typically tell you that it's not going in the right direction. And what we've tried to do as much as possible is put the blame on Austin and Washington, which is about 90% of it, and try not to get into the area of bashing local schools, because that's when you get the personalities in there. Even teachers will agree with you that Austin has overburdened them, Washington has overburdened them, but they're not going to agree with you when you start talking about the local school and that they're not good teachers. And some of them are good teachers. We have some great teachers in the system. We have some teachers that are really trying to do some good for kids. I mean, and then we have some teachers that I wish they'd retire. Yes.
Is there any recognition of a need or a game plan in place to address the media issue? The fact that we don't get news or the news that we get is distorted, that results in a lot of apathy.
Yeah, he asked the question about the media, if there's a plan in place to address it. I don't know what the answer to that is nationally. I mean, it's a real problem. Having served in Congress, it's an enormous problem. I mean, they are bombarding people, and people, when you ask them the question, do you believe the liberal media, they'll say no. But you let the liberal media run a story slamming Christian Coalition or anything, slamming Pat Buchanan, and they'll buy into it. So people do believe the liberal media. Christians believe the liberal media. I think to some degree, we're just going to have to get a little more forceful on responding. And again, it really does go back to your, I do not have the impact over your neighbors you do. And to some degree, it goes back to that. We're probably never going to have control of the national media. In some areas, you may have control of your local press. But as a whole, we're not. And we're just, it is going to be, I think, really, it's going to ultimately just become us being salt and light, if you will, in our local communities and trying to overcome it. And to do that, though, you're going to have to be an informed person, because you cannot just show up at your neighbor's doorstep and say that was a false report without understanding why it was a false report. Which means you do have to seek alternate sources. And there is a lot of stuff out there now. I mean, you know, at the national level, I think Human Events is a newspaper that's out there that's great. World Magazine is good. The Conservative Chronicle, if you like conservative editorials, is good at the national level. There's not, unfortunately, a lot of that type of material that just focuses on Texas. Eagle Forum, the Christian Coalition, the American Family Association, to name a few, put out publications, but they're not so much newspapers as is those at the national. I think that there is some talk here to see some of that stuff begin, but right now it's really not there. And we're having the Christian Coalition right now, we're having a real fit with the press's new term now for candidates that are conservatives is they are Christian Coalition candidates, which is, and they're doing it. I'll give you a little background. In 1994, the Christian conservative movement in Texas was being called the radical religious right, or just a number of different things. Is one of them calls us R cubed, radical religious right. But TSTA conference, they call us cockroaches, and so on. So we as leaders kind of in the conservative movement decided that we believed it was time to start addressing it, and we began to come back to it. And so every time they did it, we accused them of religious intolerance and bigotry and a number of other things. Those responses began to show up in the press, and the liberals are very, very sensitive to that type of thing. And what really ended it was when Ann Richards at the 1994 Democratic State Convention called us mongers of hate, and just when you think that you've gotten rid of them, those mongers of hate come back, and so on and so forth. And we responded to that. And in the headline, I don't remember how it said it, but the board bigot was in there with Ann Richards' name. And that was the last time that she or any of the Democrat establishment called us anything. So we kind of moved past that. Well, they still wanted to be able to tag us. So now the new tag is that you're a Christian Coalition candidate. Because that's a difficult tag to come back and say that you're showing religious intolerance. But they're actually taking a noun and using it as an adjective. But so it's much more difficult from where we are to start addressing it. But we are now meeting with editorial boards across the state, and with any news writer that puts that in there, we are trying to sit down with them and get past this. And I'm sure we will. But even once we get past it, just let me just be frank with you, they will replace it with something. So we will never, in my opinion, get to the place where we're not the extremist or we're not something like that, because that's just the way the beast is. The only thing we're going to have to be able to do is to as much degree as possible ignore it where you can, address the things that need to be addressed, but ignore the little things, and organize politically. And I think if we can continue to work down there. There's a group out there called the Texas Freedom Network, which is run by Cecile Richards. It's the daughter of Anna Richards. And if the truth is known, I think that group was probably put together just to counter the quote-unquote religious right because of the loss of her mother for governor. And she is getting an inordinate amount of press. I mean, this lady, every time she does something, she's in the paper. And our people are responding to that. And in my opinion, I think we need to leave her alone. She admits by her own admission that she has 300 members in this organization. We are giving it more credibility than it deserves by the attention we're giving her. Now, I say unless she does something that really deserves a response, just let her go out there and flap her wings. And the press at some point will get tired of her, just like the People's American Way did the same thing in 1994 in Texas. When it dawned on them about 6 weeks before the November election that we were fixing to win 3 state school board seats in Texas, they went nuts. And so they went, started bouncing around the state, holding press conferences, just doing everything they could do to try to get some press for these board members. And finally, you know, a statesman called me one day and said, you know, they're holding their 5th press conference they've held here, and we're tired of it, we ain't even going. And we were just ignoring them. We were letting them do their thing. And I think to a large degree, you just have to do that. And it's hard to do it when you got people out there doing things.
These very people have learned your strategy, are using your information, your films, your training, because they are local and they are working.
That's right.
As you are, just like this.
That's right.
Today in this community.
That's right.
I know.
That's right. And they really have started to understand, I think, that they're going to have to get to the grassroots. The advantage that we have, though, still, and they're actually using Chris Coalition material. I mean, it's incredible. They use our films and everything. But is that what motivates this side does not motivate the other. We're motivated by a conviction and a service to a sovereign God. They're motivated by self-interest. And any time that's the case, when we really do work, we'll beat them. Because there's just it's a whole different thing.
That is their God, however.
That is their God.
And they have much, much time to spend on their God and much money to spend on their God because that is their life, whereas ours are... Anyway,
right.
I'm very frustrated.
Yeah, right. No, I agree with you, and I feel your pain, if you will. I understand exactly what you're saying, but what I am saying, though, is when you have, if the conservative in a community organize and the liberals in a community organize, the conservatives will win.
And would you address how the, you said you could just talk to a precinct person, tell them how to lead their precinct, that would probably be an appropriate question.
Okay. Elections, in my view, are real simple. I'm probably too simple on this stuff, but when I run an election, the first question I want to know outside of candidate, the person that's running, is, okay, how many votes am I going to have to win? Well, you know, when you start talking about school board races, local school board races, will run anywhere from about 200 votes up to probably on the high end around 5,000. And this number, there's probably within this number, there's going to be 100,000 registered voters in that ballpark. Less in some areas, more in others. School board turnouts tend to be between 2% and about 10%, unless they happen to be on a ballot with... like in Austin, when we put that proposition to overturn the domestic partner thing, well, that was a very high turnout because of that, and so, but it was different. All right. So my first goal is then, okay, how many votes do I need? So then I've got to figure out, okay, I need to identify 200 voters or I need to identify 1,000 voters. There's going to be, you'll have to do the research, but there will be within this number X number of precincts, 20. It's just, we'll use that number. If you got 20 precincts, and we're going to say, all right, we got to have, for this one, we got to have 10 votes out of every precinct to win. Now, this one, we got to have 250 out of each precinct to win. And then what I do is I put precinct captains in place. Now, as far as the party structure goes, there is already an entity out there called a precinct chairman, which is elected both parties, Democrat and Republican. If they're doing their job, you don't need to find precinct captains because they're there. But typically, that's not going to be the case. Typically, precinct chairman might hold the election for you. They might put some signs out for you, but that's probably the extent of it. Now, there are exceptions, like Lewis Lowe up in this area. You know, he walks his precinct, and he hands stuff out to everybody. Everybody knows him and so on and so forth, and he's a good precinct chairman. But that is not generally the rule. So you're going to have to identify people in each precinct who will serve as the coordinator, if you will, the precinct captain. And they're going to be responsible for the voter IDing project. They're going to be responsible for coordinating it, the ID project in their precinct, getting the signs out in their precinct, you know, whatever needs to be done in that precinct. They're going to be the the point person. One of the things that, you know, they work on IDing voters, we'll talk about that in a minute. Distribution of, you know, literature, poll workers. And you can make these things as complicated or as short a list as you want. I'm not going to go into everything, but again, now once we've established how many votes we got to have, then our next task is identifying who are going to be favorable voters. And then I would go down that list, and I would just say, I would start looking down the list, and I would look for people that you know, that are like-minded, and so on and so forth. And I would get 10, 12, 15 of them, and I would have a meeting in my home, and I would talk about what we need to do, and start dividing up the responsibilities of each precinct. And when you think about this, okay, we got a precinct, let's just say it's a big one, it's got a couple thousand people in it. You get 10 or 15 people that will help you in your own precinct, and it is not a big task to walk 100 houses, or well, it's actually about 50 houses. You know, so it's, the key is, you know, identify some like-minded people to start with. Now, once you've done that, then each of those people, I would have them again go down the list and look for favorable voters in that precinct. And I don't know what that number is going to be. You may find your number just doing that. If normally that's not going to be the case, then the next thing I do is I set up some volunteer phone banking, and I actually start calling everyone on the list that's in the precinct, and I ask them, like Christian Coalition does a survey, and the first thing we ask them is, what is the most important thing to you in Grapevine? Or concerning Grapevine today. And then we ask them, would you consider yourself pro-life, pro-choice, or somewhere in between? If they say pro-life, then we ask them, would you support legislation that would ban abortion except for the life of the mother? So we're trying to establish how pro-life are they. If they say they're pro-choice or undecided, we ask them, would you support legislation that would require parental consent before an abortion? So by doing that, we're establishing how pro-life they are and how pro-choice they are. If they won't support parental consent, they're off the radar, and they're a lost cause. I mean, so you might as well scratch them. If they will support parental consent, and we're not talking about them electing them to something, it is someone that you may be able to pull in as a vote. And then we'll ask them normally a local question, and you're going to have to say what that is, a hot local issue. A lot of times it's sexy-oriented businesses. A lot of times it could be anything. And then the fourth thing I ask them is, do you think that the savings the federal government is having because of the temporary peace that's out there should be used to balance the federal budget or for additional social spending, which will kind of identify for you if you've got a fiscal conservative or fiscal liberal. And then I ask them, would you consider yourself Republican, Independent, or Democrat? Now, those questions certainly are not going to tell you everything you need to know about a person, but it's going to give you a pretty good shot, and it's a short survey because people don't like to be on the phone. And because I typically, when I get them on the phone, I'll say, will you give me 30 seconds to ask you 4 questions or 5 questions? And people will normally do that. So you're going to get about a 50% return on it. Now, from that data, then, you can start building your favorable file. And that's one of the ways. And then the key is, once we have found our list, let's just say we have found 300 favorable voters. We think we're going to need 200 to win. So we need to get our 300 votes out. And local board races, and local races, that's all it's about, guys, is getting your people out. If you get your votes out, you win, because no one shows up for these things. And the liberals do not run local races like this. So you really do have the advantage. Now, once I've identified those 300 people, then I'm going to put something in their hands, either by hand or by mail, about my candidate. And when you start talking about campaign literature, if you print 2,500 pieces of a campaign piece, a campaign piece. It'll run you about $50 more to get a professional-looking piece as one that looks like your six-year-old put it together. So please spend the $50 and get just get it. It doesn't have just has to be attractive, people, and as little words as possible. People don't like to read, so make it. I should have brought one with me. Some layouts that are attractive. But anyway, once you've got your piece, mail to your favorables. I'd mail a couple of times to the favorables. Then once early voting starts, I'd crank the phones back up again. And then your only job is to make sure these guys vote. And you call them up and you say, hey, I'm Jeff Fisher and I'm representing Lewis Lowe. And I want to know if you've voted yet. And if not, I want to remind you that polls are open from 9 to 5, whatever. And you call them until they vote. That's the whole, that is really the key. And then I always have poll workers at each polling location. And the poll workers put something in the hand of everyone who's going to vote. Now, what that does is you got a group out there that are going to come to vote for your opponent. You got a group that are going to come to vote for you, and then you got another group out there that are just there and they're not even sure why they're there. Except that it's their civic duty and they think they want to vote. Those are the guys that putting something in their hand moves. Because there is a high percentage, and depending on what poll you look at as far as how high, I personally use the number of about 25% that show up at polling places that don't know who they're going to vote for when they get there. So those guys you move around like that. Now this is real simple, and I understand that, and you know, at some point, since we're all kind of local, if you'd like, I'd be glad to get together with some of you and go into more detail as far as the 1-2-3s. But it really is a simple concept. It's IDing your voter and getting your voter out. That's the bottom line. And however you want to do that, man, get after it. I'm sure many of you have seen. I may embarrass myself here because I'm not sure if I can connect it, but connecting all the lines with four straight continuous lines without. Let's see if I can remember how to do this. Let's see. I'm not going to remember it. Yeah, I am. No, I missed one. Yeah, this one. Should have gone through here. But the point is, I had to go outside the box to make it happen. Don't be afraid to go outside the box. Just because we did that like this in 1992 doesn't mean you do it like this time. So, and that is one of the biggest problems I see in political campaigns among Christian conservatives, is that they get in races, and then the first thing they do is they call a political consultant who runs races, and then he keeps them in this little box, and they run a basic raise money, do direct mail type of thing, and we lose. And I'm not saying there's not cases when that's not fine to do, but don't get yourself in a place where you're locked into a box, because be sensitive to where God's moving, be sensitive to what's happening around you, and don't be afraid to move to make those things happen. We would not have won the state school board races around the state we had won if we'd stayed in the box. Because we were underfunded. Our vote totals, we spent less than 5 cents per vote to win those. And that's fine. And we're probably going to be like that. Now, in local races, you don't have to be like that. You ought to be able to fund a local race as well as they can fund a local race. But on the bigger ones, we are limited financially, which means you learn to play smarter. And it's really a great open system. I'm real excited about what's happening around the state, and I think the day is going to come when we see some substantial change. Yes?
Quick question. Psalms 37:1 says, do not fret about evildoers, and do not be concerned about wrongdoers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between an evildoer and a wrongdoer.
Right.
Let's just label that minority that you cannot touch evildoers. How do you persuade a wrongdoer? Someone that, this person that shows up, and he does, you know, it's just a civic duty, and he doesn't know how to vote. How would you tell us to try to be
He has there. What you know? There's evildoers, wrongdoers, and we're going to call for a simple definition. We're going to call the evildoers the people that really do have a left-wing philosophy and they understand what they believe in. And those guys, that's a good point because those guys. Let's
they have a hypocrite.
Yeah. Let me.
They're not so good.
As far as the political structure goes. Most people believe that between 15% and 20% would identify themselves as liberals. And I mean, they would be liberal on most everything. And then about 15% to 20% would identify themselves as conservatives. Okay, so this is your pro-life crowd, this is your pro-choice crowd. So that leaves in the middle between 60% and 70%. This is the vote. This is what you have to move. These guys ain't going nowhere. These guys ain't going nowhere. But these guys are all over the map. And the one that wins is which one of these two moves this middle. So if I move them, I win. If he moves them, he wins. So having said that then, that's what your message has got to go to. When you start talking about the squish out there in the middle, is that you've got to frame a message that is reasonable and moves this group. If you can do that, you're going to win. And ignore these people. Because you're not going to... I mean, you may occasionally get a Carol Everett, somebody like that. But I'm telling you, this is a rare situation. And when it happens, it's a one-on-one experience where someone took the time that their project in life was Carol Everett, like Jack Shaw did. And through years of so on, he finally introduced her to the Lord and she had a transformation. But when you talk about politically, you've got to put a message that these people out here in the middle, who, by and large, if you poll them, they would tell you they're conservative, and they probably are, but they've bought into a lot of the liberal media. Their friends may be, like teachers, are a good group. There's a lot of conservative teachers out there, but they all they hear all day is this liberal garbage. And so you've got to give them something that's makes sense to them and hits their inner conviction, but at the same time is not alarming to them. And it's a very difficult line, and I really don't have any advice as far as exactly how to write something, because I think, again, don't get in the box. I think it varies from one race to another how you address things. And local people, I find, can certainly do that much better than I could. But just remember, this is your target. This is your audience. This is who you're going after. And always think when you're doing campaign literature, is my message going to sell out there? Is this a good message? Is this an offensive message? And just depending on where you are, you can get away with more than other places. Northeast Texas, for example, is going to get away with a lot more than Austin is. You're a little more conservative. And we've been on the state school board. We've been pretty upfront. We have run those campaigns on the social issues, and because we believed in the three we won in 1994 were all Democrat seats that Republicans had never won in, and we believed the only way we would win was we had identified about 106,000 what we called Yellow Dog Democrats who had some moral conviction to them, and we put all our marbles on those people, and it was a message about parental rights. It was a message about textbook content and those types of things, and it obviously sold. We pulled in District 8, we pulled 62% in a district that previously, well. In 1992, that same district, the Democrat over the Republican, the Democrat won that seat by 45,000 votes. In 1994, we took the seat back by 68,000 votes. So we turned 120,000 votes around. And it was because, I am convinced to this day, it was because we took a conservative, moral, social message to those beer-drinking East Texas Democrats who think government ought to be there to help them, but they don't think gay rights is a cool thing. So, you know, and again, but each area has to kind of make that call for themselves.
Are there, one question, are there any books or are there any tools you would use for selecting a candidate that might, you know, be able to identify who represents your position but also would be appealing to that middle group?
Well, I may be somewhat different on candidates than many. I do not recruit or work for as a personal level for any candidate. It's not absolutely 100%. I think, and I say that because I've had to spend so much time in Austin working in the legislature, and where you have to spend your energy is with what we call the moderate Republicans who can't decide what they want to be when they grow up. So having gone through that experience, I don't recruit. Richard Neal's the kind of candidate I'm going to recruit, and we can win with those guys. Now, I will say, I wouldn't get somebody that has a reputation of being a bomb thrower out there because you're just asking for trouble. But there are plenty of godly candidates out there with good character and good moral beliefs. But they need to go into office with their moral beliefs. Don't get them in there and then try to go in there and convert them, because I'm telling you, it don't happen very often. And, you know, so that's my calling. Well, thanks. And, yes. Yeah.
Can I mention names?
Yeah.
The Republican Party is the growing party. It is an excellent brochure. It goes all the way back to the slavery issue, everything within our background. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And let me pass out some of this too. This is just some samples. This was a scorecard I did when I was with AFA over how the legislators voted. This was two sessions ago, so it's not current, but it'll give you an idea of what kind of thing. And you can do the same thing locally, and I recommend that you do, which helps elected officials do what's right when they understand that their votes are going to get published. The squish voters are more likely. This is a little piece on voter identification. It's not very in depth, but it'll give you some ideas. This is all the elected officials in the state, federal government. And this is just a copy of a voter guide. And I give this to you because these things are great for local elections too. So, you know, just as an idea of something to run from. Well, thanks for coming.